The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hello everyone, we're back with Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. And today we're going to be doing episode 13, Military Life. We're going to go into Louis's history with the military and find out quite a bit. So where would you like to kick us off?
Well, I had graduated from Cornell Law School.
Mm-hmm, right.
And it was during the Korean War. And I was very lucky. They let me finish law school. Mm-hmm. So I came out as an attorney in the Ordnance Corps, both trained as an ordnance officer. And I also took a course in military justice in law school. And then I had my training as an attorney. So I had a report for active duty right after law school.
Mm-hmm. Straight to Korea.
Well, no.
No?
No, it's a long story.
Oh, okay.
Here I was. I was driving through the looking glass. Mm-hmm. I was in my Ford convertible. It was an old one, on the New Jersey Turnpike, heading south to a new life at Fort Dix. I was in costume. I was wearing a full military uniform, and the thoughts kept coming in fast succession. I said to myself, "You're just a lousy second lieutenant, a nothing. Be humble. Remember the summer training you had 3 years ago with the 82nd Airborne Division down in that furnace of Fort Lee, Virginia? You lost 18 pounds in 6 weeks."
And what is the 82nd Airborne Division?
Well, that's the Army parachute troops, the airborne troops, mm-hmm. that jump out of planes and then fight.
Mm-hmm.
They jump like a combat jump is 500 feet. You jump with heavy equipment, maybe 100 pounds or more of equipment.
How are your knees?
And the chute opens, bang, and you're down. Mm-hmm. There's no air time. They want to get you down fast.
Yeah.
That's the short combat jump. Most of them are up higher, but then you become a target. So these are tough, tough guys.
Oh, yeah.
This is like the SEALs. This is like the Rangers. That's the group. That's the group that you're in. They're tough, tough guys. And they used the non-commissioned officers from the 82nd Airborne, the corporals and sergeants, to train these college kids that were coming in from the universities, mm-hmm. And the ROTC to become officers. Well, first of all, the enlisted men in these combat outfits don't like officers in non-combat outfits.
Yeah.
So there's that issue. And then there's a socioeconomic issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then these kids are not hand-to-hand combat fighters. The ROTC kids mostly do administrative work in the mm-hmm. military, or mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Although I shouldn't say that infantry are infantry. They fight, they're land soldiers. Anyhow, they ran us, these guys. They ran us day and night. We were up at 5 a.m., rain or heat and combat boots, heavy fatigues, which is an outfit like a heavy canvas outfit, and helmet liners. That was like helmets made out of plastic, and it was like 98 degrees.
Oh.
And at night there was no air conditioning in the barracks. You sweat right through the mattress. Not your sheets and your clothes, you through the mattress. And out in the field, we were out in the field for 2 weeks, living outdoors in tents, marching with our M1s in the Virginia fine dust. There was dust there, and we fired live ammunition, and we were being tormented by these corporals and sergeants from the 86th Airborne. They were animals. They would yell, "Wash that floor down with hot soapy water." So that was all they heard. We heard hot soapy water. So that's what we called the sergeant, hot soapy water.
And you said you used the M1s?
Oh yeah, we used everything. You learn, especially in the Ordnance Corps, you become expert in the use and the understanding. I'll tell you more about it in the story about weapons. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you more about what the ordnance does. Anyhow, the sergeant that was yelling hot soapy water was right. It works. It really does disinfect. And Florence Nightingale must have been his mentor, because that's what I looked it up. And Florence Nightingale was screaming to the nurses, "Use hot soapy water." Anyhow, they resented us. What do you mean resented us? Those 82nd Airborne non-commissioned officers hated us. And the college kids were passing out all over the place. Two guys died from heat prostration.
Really?
Yeah. It was tough. After 2 weeks in the field, with the lice and the chiggers and the bugs eating at you, you know,
sounds
chiggers
awful.
Like, they were like ticks.
Yeah.
I came into the barracks, and I stood under the shower in my uniform with my fatigues, my canvas uniform, my boots, my helmet liner, and I turned the water right on and put the soap right on the top of everything. And I swore that I would never, ever forget the pleasure of a hot shower as long as I lived.
Yeah.
And to this day, I don't ever step in the shower without saying thank you. It's a joy. Taking a hot shower is a joy. Congress investigated when these guys were passing out and dying. You know, the parents were a little upset.
Of course.
They called their congressman. They said, what's going on in the military? And there was an investigation. And the 82nd Airborne was told to lay off and stop hazing the kids.
Did you know the two gentlemen that passed away?
No, I didn't. But they were in the same company.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Right.
It was 1951, so it talks about hazing in the military. I'm going to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
And here's hazing about the people who are above you in rank,
right,
who really put it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, we thought that we might be frozen in to go to Korea because they were still fighting there.
Yeah.
But they let us go back to school.
Okay.
So now we went back to school.
We got a little break.
Yeah, and I was in law school at the time. So we had Professor Moss was the reserve colonel in law school, and he gave the JAG course, Military Judge Advocate General, a military course in Cornell Law School at night. And my military records now showed a good reserve year. So when I went on active duty, I was an ordnance officer. I was 2 years older than the other second lieutenants who were called to active duty, and I was an attorney. And I had taken the JAG course. I
had
a good year.
For sure,
so, yeah. I was a little bit different than the average second lieutenant that was called on duty. And the Ordnance Corps handled the development and procurement of weapons and ammunition, and the maintenance and repair of vehicles and tanks, and the development and procurement of all Army missiles, including anti-aircraft missiles, and the disposal of unexploded bombs. That's where your life expectancy is described in minutes. You know what that is called? EOD. And it's unexploded bombs. So if you're out with the mines
mm-hmm.
that are left there that have to be, you know, you're talking about demines. That's the Ordnance Corps that does it. That's what I was in.
Oh, boy.
Arrive at Fort Dix in my convertible, and I show my orders at the gate, and I receive my first salute, which is, if you're an officer, that's very exciting.
It's a big
deal, your first salute.
Of course.
Instead of being marched to the barracks, I was advised by the colonel's secretary when I went to the office that I was to meet him at the officers' club for lunch.
Oh.
Wow, what a difference. What a difference. Well, he rose to greet me. There was no mistaking him. First of all, there were those eagles on the shoulder. That's a colonel with the eagles.
Mm.
He was sort of short, muscular, and very old, because I was very young. He had a chest full of ribbons. You know, the military wear these ribbons, including the enlisted man's combat infantry badge. That is a blue ceramic piece of a long, narrow badge, and it has a insignia in it. And that means that you're a combat infantryman. You earn that by being in combat. So you also only get that if you're an enlisted man. Officers don't get that.
Huh.
So it told me, and I also saw a 3-year good behavior medal, which they give you if you stay out of trouble for 3 years as an enlisted man, you get a medal. That's how bad it is. Anyhow, I knew that the colonel was up through the ranks.
Right.
To tell me that he was an enlisted man before he became an officer. So if you know how to read ribbons on the military, you can learn a lot about somebody by looking at all the stuff they're wearing. He said, Lieutenant, sit down and welcome to my unit. I see that you are an attorney and an Ivy League graduate. So I think we should have an informal relationship. I will call you Lewis, and you, Lewis, may call me sir.
Oh.
That was my introduction to the military. But he was really a very fine person, and he must have pulled strings to get me because he needed an attorney, and he requested me and requisitioned me from the Ordnance Corps. I found out later that it was a temporary loan and that the Army had quite different plans for me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, my colonel wore cross swords, the brass insignia with the cross swords, on his collar. And I told you, you can read from the uniforms a lot about him. That was the infantry.
Okay.
The ordnance had a bomb, a flaming bomb, which was our insignia. The signal corps had cross flags, so you can tell.
Mm-hmm.
The foot soldiers who do the fighting are in the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And the first ribbon he had was the Distinguished Service Cross. That's the second highest medal awarded for valor.
Wow.
Under the Congressional Medal of Honor. So there, and then he had the Purple Heart, which is a purple badge.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had an oak leaf cluster. An oak leaf cluster is a little metal piece of in the shape of an oak leaf that they put on the badge or on the ribbon, which means you've won it a second time. And if you get a silver one, it's you won it five times. But you don't want the Purple Heart five times. But he had it twice. So he had, was wounded twice in combat. Well, it tells you something. It gives you, you're looking at their resume.
Mm-hmm.
And right on their shirt, they wear the resume. And his secretary sent me to my accommodations, which turned out to be a two-bedroom suite with a semi-private bath.
Oh.
So the colonel was really, well, he got it. The colonel was connected.
He knew
people. When you get that kind of accommodation for your staff, for a second lieutenant, it's usually captain above get that. So my unit with this colonel was a summary courts marshal, and I was the defense attorney. The prosecutor was Captain Harry Strauss, and he was a professional soldier, a West Point graduate, and a really nasty guy. And, you know, he didn't like me because I was the Ivy League boy coming in. And he was above me. He was a captain. And again, this rank where you can look down and torment the guy below you
right.
if you didn't like
couldn't
him.
Wait.
So, all right, I'd walk in, I'd say, good morning, Captain Strauss. He says, rest, nobody asked you for a weather report. And he meant, and he meant it. That's how he greeted me in the morning. I said good morning to him. That SOB, he didn't like it when I started whopping the tail off him in those small trials for AWOL, absent mm-hmm. without leave, DUI, driving while intoxicated, driving under the influence,
mm-hmm.
refusing to obey a lawful order. How do you win those cases? Well, you check the docket well ahead of time. Then you speak to the accused, who are often being held in a stockade. You just don't go in cold to court. And you get the witnesses, and you locate them, and you speak to the witnesses for the defense, and you produce them at the trial.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so easy. But there were no more pro forma defenses where you just show up and, you know, and don't do it much. I got telephone testimony from a local priest confirming that my client didn't come back from leave on time because his mother had died while he was on lawful leave. And he had to bury her, and it was 2 days before he could get back.
Mm-hmm.
And he phoned in and told everyone. So I got him off. The doctor testified that the accused was under the influence of a prescribed medication and not alcohol. And the medication mimicked the drunkenness. I got him off from drunk driving.
Oh.
Then there was three sergeants who conspired to frame a private. And they swore that the private refused to get off his cot and then attacked them. And their stories were identical. Three sergeants, all talking about this poor private.
Of course.
And I was defending the private. They clearly had rehearsed carefully.
Mm-hmm.
I cross-examined them one at a time without the others being present. You can say, I don't want them in the room. They go out and you get one at a time, one witness at a time. And when it came to the details, like whether my client was wearing his glasses or whether he was in combat boots, or whether he had shoes or slippers on, they were inconsistent and conflicting. I drew a chart showing where their testimony was exactly the same and where it was wildly different. It was clear that they were lying.
Mm-hmm.
You could see on each of the essential points they were identical because
yeah.
they had rehearsed the story
right.
and everything else. They were all over the place. So they dismissed that case.
Good.
Well, the guy's name was Smithson. So Private Smithson had and two of his friends came by to thank me. And afterwards, they came to my back, to my room, you know, in the bachelor's officer's quarters, and they presented me with my first legal fee, a stolen field jacket. I knew they had to steal it. It was best just to keep it in the closet. I was afraid to put it on. I couldn't wear it. So that was my first fee as a lawyer. Sergeant Coswell was in the stockade in isolation, and he was charged with assault and battery for cursing, attacking, and striking a superior officer, his captain. It looked like the sergeant would do big time in Leavenworth. So I went to visit him. The MPs, the military police,
mm-hmm.
walked me through the prison. They were concerned for my safety, but it was unnecessary because I was the ticket out of there for many of those prisoners, and they would fight to the death to protect me. I have to worry I could walk through the prison. My client was huddled in the corner of a black box. Do you know what a black box is? It's a solitary confinement unit. It's made of metal, and it's a square box. About
How big?
I would say it's about 5 feet tall, 5 feet long, and 4 feet wide.
Oh,
it's got a little pallet in it, and it's got a commode in it. You know, a
that
toilet.
Is so small.
No cover or anything, just a ceramic toilet. Tiny. There was hardly room. You couldn't lie down. You had to curl up to lie down. There was no windows, only a vent on the metal roof. And the food was slipped through on a slot at the bottom of the middle door. And the odor was murder, was sweat and urine, you know.
I bet.
And the sergeant, and by the way, the military says they don't exist.
Yeah,
I was there. Lines of them. I have no reason
so
to say.
So they do this to anyone in the military who's convicted of a crime?
No, if they want a pension, it's like solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. If they didn't like you and they really wanted to give it to you, they put you in there.
That's awful.
It was terrible. The sergeant was crouched in the corner, in the dark corner in that box, that black box they called it. He was unshaved, and he only had his underpants on. So I had him clothed, and I had him move to a chair in a tiny office, and I interviewed him. He says, "Lieutenant, sir, I did it, and I expect to be punished." "You did what?" "I punched out that captain, the son of a bitch." I listened to his story carefully. There was a lot of work to do. That's what he said. The case went to trial. Captain Strauss, who was the prosecutor, who was the guy giving me the hard time, he was a West Pointer. He was going for a 10-year prison term and a dishonorable discharge from the military.
That's a big sentence, yeah.
Right, well, he beat up a captain.
Yeah.
You know, a sergeant doesn't beat up a captain.
Yeah.
At my election, the case was tried before an all-officer panel of majors and colonels.
Wow.
And they had stern looks. They were as stiff as their starch uniform, no starch uniform. And the corporal
was... So the panel was pretty much the jury.
The panel is the jury. They are both the jury and the judge.
Oh,
the
boy.
Presiding, they have the senior officer, who's usually a colonel or a lieutenant colonel. He makes all the rulings like the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And then they vote on whether he's guilty or not, like the jury. And then they all agree on a sentence. So they were the judge and the jury.
Oh, okay.
And the corporal who witnessed the assault testified that the sergeant, who appeared to be drunk, had attacked the captain and struck him several times, knocking him to the floor. Called him a son of a bitch and marched out of the captain's office. I said, "No cross-examination." The military police described how drunk the sergeant appeared to be, ranting and raving when they arrested him just after they had been called by the corporal. No questions. The medics testified as to the bruises, the facial lacerations. Really, it was just a black eye and a bloody nose that came, but he beat him in the head. No questions, I had no questions.
Did you let them establish their case?
I did. I did. Well, wait till you hear what's coming. Strauss figured he had a slam dunk. Next came the captain to polish off the kill. You know what he said. "I was innocently minding my own business when this unprovoked assault occurred." Okay, now it was time to make my move. "Captain, how many women do you have working in your office?" "7? All civilians?" "Does the sergeant work in the same office? Are they there all the time, every day, all of them?" Strauss jumps up and he says, "Objection. This is all irrelevant and immaterial and has nothing to do with this vicious attack." He was on his feet.
Yeah.
"Well, Mr. President, sir, I will," and we called the head of the panel, the president, "sir, I will tie it all in and it will be extremely relevant." "Objection denied. Proceed." "How did you get along with your staff, particularly the women?" The captain was squirming. "Did you ever talk dirty in front of these women employees?" The objection was denied, and the captain was turning red. He was glaring at me. "How dare you impugn my integrity? I am an officer and in charge of this office. Answer the question." "No, never." "Have you ever touched any of these women with whom you work on a daily basis, on their backsides, on their breasts?" "You are under oath." His eyes were bulging. "No, never." 7 women took the stand.
Oh, my.
One after the other. They told about the captain telling dirty jokes, touching their breasts, putting his hands on their behinds. Some of these women were married with children. I asked them why they never complained. They were afraid to tell their husbands. Who would believe them? They would be the guilty ones for tempting and encouraging the captain. A few were married to enlisted men. Well, if you were married to an enlisted man, that even would be a greater problem. The women could remember the exact dates because many of them had been at office birthday parties or holidays when it happened. They looked straight at the captain, and he looked down. They cried. They were nervous. One sobbed and shook. The panel of high-ranking officers was clearly agitated. Boy, were they agitated.
Mm-hmm.
The women all swore that the sergeant was in the room most of the times in clear view of what the captain was doing.
Wow.
Captain Strauss continually and strenuously objected. I kept saying, sirs, I'll tie it all in. The captain sat there, now wringing his hands. Sweat was staining his shirt. Sergeant Coswell, take the stand. Well, the sergeant comes up there. He wore his combat ribbons. Remember, I told you you could tell by these ribbons.
Mm-hmm.
He sat straight in his chair. He was a master sergeant. Three up, three under. Three stripes on the top, three stripes underneath.
Hmm.
That is a very high-ranking enlisted man.
Hmm.
It's one of the most respected ranks in the Army. He looked directly at the panel when he testified, but he was contrite. He said, I couldn't take it anymore. The captain kept doing it, grabbing them, rubbing against them, touching their personal parts. The ladies cried. I felt helpless. They might lose their jobs. He would probably get away with it. What were you thinking? I thought that this was not the action of an honorable, responsible officer, but of a lowlife. I couldn't take it anymore. I was ashamed of him. I got drunk, and my feelings of shame and disgust got out of control. And I thrashed him. He said, I did it for the good of the service. God forgive me.
Good for him.
I did it for the good of the service. God forgive me.
Good for him.
Well.
Good man.
They had to do something. They didn't know what to do. They came back in an hour. Loss of 30 days pay and reduction in grade from master sergeant to staff sergeant.
That's it.
Word spread like wildfire all over the biggest military base in the world. Our post commander was a 4-star general. He was furious. Some Ivy League lawyer got a sergeant who beat up a captain right on the base, got him off with a touch on the wrist. No way, no how.
Why were you in trouble for defending the sergeant?
Well, because it's military discipline. And it was my job, but he didn't want wise guy lawyers running the military. This is not civilian life, you know.
How did you feel?
I did my job, you know. I was thrilled that I helped the guy. The sergeant was going to go away for 10 years to have prison, heavy labor. So I didn't want that. Anyhow, the general called a meeting of all field grade officers, majors and above, in the theater. And he was livid. He ranted for an hour about how he wasn't running a damn kindergarten, but a military installation. And he told these, they were all major and up. He told them to enforce strict military discipline, and there would be no smart-ass Ivy League lawyers on his post. I had to get out of there. So two good things happened. One, Captain Strauss, the guy that was giving me the hard time from West Point, he was married and he was living off the base in Trenton, New Jersey. And he was officer of the day for the entire Fort Dix. That's the biggest military installation in the world. And he was the officer of the day for a particular weekend. He was in charge. The generals were off playing golf and going to New York and so on, and he was in charge. He was the ranking officer with full authority and responsibility for running Fort Dix when the hurricane hit. In those days, they didn't have weather prediction, and the storm tore up the place. It knocked down electrical and telephone wires. Trees were blocking the roads. Captain Strauss couldn't be reached, and he was in deep trouble. So I took off my name tag, and I put on the Officer of the Day armband. It was an armband with an elastic on it that said OD, Officer of the Day.
Uh-huh.
And I started ordering the cleanup and the rescue operations. And
took
I
charge.
And I took off. I signed Strauss's name. And the next day I was able to reach him in Trenton. And I told him not to try to come in, that I had him covered. Well, Captain Strauss, that tough West Point guy, became my benefactor.
So what happened to you?
Well, some of my friends had been drafted and were going through basic training at Fort Dix, and it wasn't hard for me to claim that they were witnesses in my cases and that I needed to meet with them. So I had them pulled from their units, and they reported to my suite, and they took private showers and naps in my two-room suite. And on weekends, I drove them to town for Chinese food.
Nice.
I had these.
That's very kind of you.
That was nothing. I mean, it was the least you could do. And I had met a corporal by the name of Eric Kupferberg, at the post commander's office when I first arrived at Fort Dix. So I included Eric in our Chinese food outings. Eric was running the office of the AG, the Adjutant General, and the Adjutant General issued all of the orders for the transfer of personnel. So Eric knew that I was being followed by the MPs, the military police, and that the post commander was after me.
Uh-oh.
The four-star general didn't want me to have a happy life. He was mad at me.
He had it out for you.
And Eric made a few phone calls, and he cut orders for me to immediately leave Fort Dix and travel to Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland and attend the officer's course there, train there. So Captain Strauss took me aside before I left, and he told me that he had placed a coded letter in my 201 personnel file, and that I should have a good experience in the Army as a result. The letter turned out to say that I was an extremely competent officer and should be offered a regular Army permanent commission, and I was to be treated as, quote, one of us, unquote. Mm. I knew that those were West Pointer's code words.
Oh.
So I was supposed to be treated as a West Pointer, part of
Very
the fraternity, part
good.
Of the inside group. Well, that is very, very significant in the Army.
Hmm. Yes.
And I'll tell you what happened, because after that, my days were very happy. I was treated as one of the boys. The colonels were friendly to me, took me in, bought me drinks, played golf with me, and so on. So here I was a second lieutenant and then a first lieutenant being treated as an equal with the senior officers.
That's great.
Now, on the way to Aberdeen, Proving Grounds, I met with my career management officer down in the Pentagon. And that place is huge, deceptively huge. It's got rings of officers within rings of more officers within rings of more officers. And the captain was very friendly and clearly wanted to be helpful. He said, Lieutenant, I see where you have volunteered for Korea. That's very commendable, but the Army has other plans for you. Just complete your training course at, Aberdeen. And you will have your assignment, which should be very exciting for you. Good luck. So I was going to have a permanent assignment. It did not occur to me at that time that the FBI was completing a top secret security investigation relating to my future military job.
Oh.
I had a very wild thing coming at me.
Oh, okay.
It was coming towards me. Anyhow.
And where were you now at this point?
Well, I was moving. I was in a station now in Aberdeen Proving Grounds, which is a wild place also. The military installations are unbelievable. Anyhow, at that time, officers paid for our own uniforms, but mine were customized by cutting out a curved panel under each arm so that everything was form-fitted to the body. The laundry and dry cleaning were always there for you, and they were almost no charge. Starch was so heavy that everything was starched that you had to literally force open your shirts, pry them open in order to get your hands in. You couldn't get your hands in the sleeves, so we all starched together. Haircuts were available by appointment for officers. The officers' club had 25-cent cocktails and no limits. The post exchange, which was called a PX, had anything you wanted. It was like a department store, and it was for far less than the outside. Now, the latest movies were shown every night for 25 cents.
Do you remember some of your favorites that you watched?
I remember they were Technicolor.
Very cool. And the cocktails, did you have a favorite?
Martinis.
Okay.
I drank shaken, martinis.
Shaken, not stirred?
Yeah, right. Shaken, not stirred. I since have stopped drinking gin and switched to vodka.
Oh, okay.
But the gin was knocking me out. Anyhow, going to school at Aberdeen Proving Grounds, which was the home of the Ordnance Corps, was like a trip to military toyland. We fired every type of weapon. I told you that this is what we did weapons. We took them apart and put them back together in the dark. We worked with dummy shells, cartridges, grenades, and rockets. One day we were taken to a very hilly area, and we sat around three of the latest tanks. They were heavy, treaded, you know, armored giants. They were huge. And the sergeant who was teaching us, giving the course there, said, the stick and the gas pedal is all you need to know. So it was a rod-type lever, like the old floor-mounted gear shift. that steered the monster. That was the steering wheel. You didn't have a wheel, you had a rod, and you pushed it in the direction. All you had to do was push it in the direction you wanted to go and hit the gas.
Wow.
And that's how you steered. Six integrated Chrysler engines roared, and off you went.
Wow. And they just let you just hop in the tank.
Oh, yeah.
And take for a spin.
We were officers. We did that. Yeah. It was fine. It was okay to knock down a couple of trees, and we did. They knocked down trees. I ran mine through some deep mud puddles, really deep. We never thought about what we were doing to the land.
Yeah. Can be pretty destructive.
It was.
It sounds, I'm not going to lie, it sounds pretty fun, though.
It was a lot of, it was great, yeah.
What were the grounds like?
Well, Aberdeen Proving Grounds is about 100 square miles. It's not your little outpost. Just think of 100 square miles in Florida.
Wow.
Aberdeen had been in business since 1917. Hmm. And what business was that? Well, the young officers that were going through training were not told. But I was concerned after I saw what the Army was doing to the hills and the trees of the large tank testing area. The ruts were a mile deep, and the area was becoming a wasteland. And at the other side of Aberdeen Proving Grounds was Edgewood Arsenal. And nobody knows about Edgewood Arsenal. That's where they really didn't want you to know what was going on. At Edgewood, we were manufacturing weapons and ammunition, including nasty poison gases like phosgene and atropine, better known as nerve gas. We also put them in the artillery shells with proximity fuses. We put the gas in an artillery shell, and the proximity fuse, you didn't have to hit a target. You just had to get near enough so that the radio waves from the shell bounced back and caused the shell to explode in midair. And my Iranian classmates, because we had an international class, we took officers from other countries, and I had a captain and a major from Iran. That was from the Shah's army at that time. And they told me that we also supplied them with this illegal stuff.
Yeah.
They had these phosgene and atropine, and they had the proximity fuses.
Yeah, the U.S. is known to also supply the enemy forces sometimes as well.
So. Yeah. This had been going on since 19...
So, you yourself were putting the gas into these containers? Like
no, I wasn't.
For?
That was going on...
This
was going on in Edgewood Arsenal.
Got it, okay.
And civilians were doing
civilians
that
Civilians were doing it.
Yeah, mostly women.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing there were some risks and
associated
with that.
Yeah, well, they all wore masks and stuff. Mm-hmm. I was exposed to gas. I had to run through tents full of mustard gas and stuff with... With
as
masks
part of your
on.
Training, right?
Yeah, sure, sure. And also chlorine. They did chlorine. That's a terrible thing that was also used in 1917. And then they made it illegal. They were also just starting to test herbicides and the precursors to Agent Orange. Huh. Remember Agent Orange?
Yeah.
So pollution, contamination, it was horrible. The Army never concerned itself with pollution or contamination. A large part of Aberdeen Proving Grounds was off limits. You get 100 square miles off limits. You couldn't go in there and come out unharmed. Who was going to tell the major general running Aberdeen to clean up his act?
Yeah.
You got a three-star general running that place. You don't talk to him. The only one that talks to him is the four-star general.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lieutenant Rollison was going through this training with me, and he was always next to me on the roll call list. It would be Rest, Rollison, Ross, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the gun range officer called us to our positions at the outdoor firing range. Rollison was a Baptist. He didn't believe in drinking or smoking or dancing. He was married, and he lived in a trailer with his wife and two kids. And he invited me to a home-cooked dinner, and he was very anxious to become a weapons instructor. He stood next to me as we were issued 30 caliber ammunition for our first targets. We were out on the practice range. Mm-hmm. We had to qualify. There would be 10 shots each from four positions. Prone on your stomach, you shot 10 shots.
Mm-hmm.
Kneeling, where you kneel on one knee and shot 10 shots. And sitting, so you had, and standing. Mm-hmm. So you had one sitting, one standing, one on a knee, and one on your stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And we would adjust the metal sights of our M1 rifles. Okay, we'd fire a couple of shots to check the windage and elevation to see if the sights were correct.
Uh-huh.
And then we would commence firing.
So what is an M1? And is that what you already... had mentioned before?
Yeah, an M1 is a rifle that was developed in World War II It is gas chambered. It has a gas chamber in it. When you fire the weapon, it automatically puts the next cartridge into the barrel. Mm-hmm. It's a you pull the lever back once, uh-huh. and then after that it's automatic. Bang 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 bang, uh-huh. and it's a semi-automatic weapon really, mm-hmm. and it's a very well-designed weapon.
And it was developed by us.
Yeah, it was easy to maintain, and. It was a very effective weapon. We used to have single bolt Springfield rifles where you had to get each one in World War One. You had to put a cartridge in and then shut the bolt and then fire and then pull it back in the cartridge. This was all gas operated, bing, 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 the chamber.
A lot more sophisticated. Oh,
and it could take smooth. And it could take maltreatment too. You could take it in the water, submerge it. You can roll it in mud, wash it off. It worked.
Oh,
it was very good.
Did you enjoy it?
No, I didn't. We, as an officer, we could take our own weapons into combat, and I would not have chosen the M1.
No.
It's too heavy a weapon. Heavy to carry.
What was your choice?
Oh, I would have, well, if it depends on the kind of combat. If you're going close combat, I would have chosen a 26 caliber weapon, something less cumbersome. And
what about long range?
Well, long range, they have sniper rifles.
Not too long range.
50 caliber thing, you hit somebody a mile away.
Yeah.
But they were pretty good. Mm-hmm. They were pretty good. Now we have the AR-15s and so on. Anyhow, nobody knew that I had been firing weapons since high school. I wasn't just trained in the Ordnance Corps. I was second best shot on the Cornell Rifle Team, and I was president of the Cornell Rifle and Pistol Club. And Cornell was only... second to Maryland in the national competitions, in the national championships. So we had beaten West Point, and we had beaten Annapolis.
Impressive.
And we had beaten all others except Maryland. It was the only school in the country that was better. And so hitting a 22 caliber bullet hole, just a hole at 50 feet without any telescopic sights was not a problem. In other words, I could shoot a shot through a piece of paper 50 feet away and then aim for the bullet hole.
And then shoot it again.
And hit the bullet hole.
Oh.
The Army qualified, qualifications were a joke for me. I had fired M1s many times. All you had to do was take a deep breath, let it out slowly, squeeze out a round into the center of the bullseye. It was easy for me. 70, you had to shoot 70 to qualify. So I shot 70 very easily. And then I placed one or two of my extra rounds into each of Rollison's targets. Just enough so that he was the most decorated marksman they had seen in a long time. And the scorekeepers never figured out that Rollison's target had extra shots. They just totaled up his score.
Wow.
Rollison never knew. I never told him. It was great to see him marching around with all those sharpshooter medals on his chest. And he became a range officer.
Oh, that's great.
I want to be a range officer.
And when did you learn of your permanent assignment?
Well, after the six-week course at Aberdeen, mm-hmm. I got the orders, and they said, report to Camp Wellfleet, Massachusetts.
Okay.
That's right. August on Cape Cod. So, I knew what it was. It was Strauss's letter in there. Mm-hmm. They gave me this choice deal. They were still finishing my security clearance, I had a few weeks to go. So my orders read, to assist the quartermaster officer. So I showed up, and Commander Colonel Lambert, who's the commander of the post there, invited me to lunch. And he told me that he was asked to be helpful to me.
Oh.
Somebody contacted him. So he said I would be his golf companion every afternoon for the rest of the summer.
Wow.
While everyone else was training artillery National Guardsmen, he and I would play golf.
Well, it seems like you didn't need much practice. So, better to go golfing, right?
I had a wonderful time. Maybe in the mornings I'd like to decorate the officers' club. So the plan was to spend the mornings in town buying old fish nets, conch shells, anchors, worn lobster traps, lanterns, and outdated rods and reels, and decorating the officers' club.
Nice.
There was an art gallery with its own school. So they guided me in painting a large mural.
Oh.
And it was a fully rigged sailing ship, which went into the officers club. And then right on it said USS Lambert, which was the colonel's name.
You worked that in there very nicely.
I tried to make a friend. Anyhow, the club was redecorated. My golf game was getting pretty good. And at night, they showed the latest movies on the beach without any charge.
Mm.
And we smoked cigars.
Wow, it sounds quite nice.
It was terrific.
So after all that time, did you finally get your assignment?
Yep, finally, on September 10th, the orders came in. And it said, without delay, I was to report to the Ordnance Procurement Office at 180 Varick Street, 5th floor, New York City, New York, 2nd Army District. Well, that location was right between Wall Street and Greenwich Village in downtown Manhattan.
Oh,
now, what the Army was doing downtown, I didn't know what I was doing. It was I show up there. It's a 40-floor high-rise office building. It was built around 1930. So it was sort of arty, you know, it was nice.
And what kind of assignment was that they had planted you right into Manhattan?
Well, I didn't know. I knew that they had done a complete background search, so it had to be something spooky.
Oh.
In fact, I had the full FBI super secret clearance. So the Ordnance Corps was in charge of developing and manufacturing the Army's guided missiles. How did they go about it? They had a procurement section within the Ordnance Corps that was responsible for working with the designers at Redstone Arsenal, which was Wernher von Braun, and hiring contractors to do the research and development for new weapons. They would then contract with companies for their manufacture. The Army people came and went, so there had to be a permanent civilian cadre, or base.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 6 Army officers and about 600 civilian government workers of various ranks. They were all tucked away at 180 Varick Street. We occupied 3 stories, 3 floors of the building with inner staircases and elevators. The office was not listed on the building directory nor in any phone book. The elevator deposited you into a small reception room on the 5th floor, which in turn had ceiling cameras and unmarked locked doors that required security clearance to enter, or you rang the bell and you were buzzed in. Once inside, there was a reception area which had local security guards, but they actually were military guards. And there was no sign or name anywhere, just small gold numbers on a set of doors. The large open area on the 5th floor had desks for about 300 civilian employees, mostly young women. They handled the paperwork for buying rifles and other standard weapons. They bought ammunition, they bought tanks and military vehicles. Each purchasing section had one military officer assigned to report back to Colonel Cohn. He was the boss, and he pronounced his name Colonel Cohn very carefully when he answered the phone. Colonel Cohn, C-O-N-E.
And why? Why was he so concerned about that?
Because he didn't want to be Jewish. Cohn is a Jewish name, C-O-H-E-N.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't think you would figure that out. So he would answer the phone, Colonel Cohn, C-O-N-E, speaking. He sat alone in a glassed-in office at the end of an open space on the 5th floor, an eagle on his right collar, and an ordnance brass bomb symbol on the other collar tab. You didn't salute him when you went into his office. There was no saluting since this wasn't a military base.
I see.
The guided missile section was behind glass walls on the west side of the area, facing the Hudson River. You could see the Hudson River.
Oh, beautiful.
There was another man security guard and a security desk at the entrance to the guided missile section. Our team in guided missiles consisted of 5 civilians and 1 military attorney with the support of 6 secretaries, and we negotiated and drew contracts for all of the Army's anti-missile missiles. They were being installed around America's cities and key military installations on hidden subterranean platforms with pneumatic lifts. Much of this activity in this unit was top secret. Everything seemed to be stamped at least confidential, including my paycheck. Somebody was having fun with the security stamp. My Christmas greeting card from Colonel Cohn was stamped confidential. No, not really. But everything you did that was confidential. Any letter you had was ordered. Any letter at all was stamped confidential. They just didn't want anyone to look at anything.
Right.
And the really top secret stuff was in a safe that we had in the office. I don't even talk about it. And the only 2 people had access to this safe, the chief lawyer, which was Joe Larkin, and I. And those were the only people that could get into that safe. And one day, Joe Larkin left the safe open. He had 6 kids. He had done it twice before. And that's, you're terminated for that.
Oh.
And I took the rap for him.
Oh, that was nice of you.
I said I had neglected to close the safe. Colonel Cohn called me and he says, Res, don't give me that nonsense. I know you didn't leave the safe open. He says, just don't take the rap for Joe Larkin anymore.
And
and
what
Joe
would you
Larkin
do with
wound
those?
up becoming the chief lawyer for IBM.
Oh.
And he never sent me a piece of business.
Wow.
So we were like,
and
I saved his
That's
career.
Not good.
So now
he's
passed
on.
What
did you do with the documents after you read them? Like, was there a procedure of
well,
how
anything?
To get rid of
we,
them,
yeah,
or?
All our stuff was we were doing contractual work, and all the stuff was under lock and key, really double, triple locked, and nobody had access. The only ones that say to have access to the contracts we were working on was Joe Larkin and myself.
Mm-hmm. And were you working alone at the time, or did you have a team?
Well, we had a team, and the negotiation team was headed by Walter Byland. He was a civilian. He was an older guy, balding, heavy set, tall, well-dressed, older man. He was the ranking civilian in our unit, and he wore vests with everything. And his number two man was Arthur Keene, who was a slim, white-haired gentleman in his 50s. He was the equivalent of a major, and Byland was the equivalent of a full colonel. And Arthur Keene used to wear Brooks Brothers clothing. He was really dapper. He had three-button suits fit him like a glove. And he loved the opera, and he was single, and we got along very well. And he insisted on inviting me as his season guest for Monday nights at the Met.
Oh, that sounds beautiful.
And he had seats in the first row dress circle.
Wow.
So I had the season
good
at
seats.
The Met. He was very nice. And Joe Larkin was the senior civilian attorney. And as I said, he became the international senior attorney for IBM. Mm-hmm. And his associate, his civilian assistant, was Angelo Saraceno. And I was the military attorney. I was known as an 8101. That is an MOS, that is a description of your military occupational status. And 8101 means legal officer.
I see. And weren't you awfully low ranking to handle this kind of job?
Extremely so, extremely so. But they weren't interested in rank. They were interested in qualifications. And I was probably the only ordnance officer around that was both trained in ordnance and trained in a good law school and admitted to the bar. So
yeah.
they liked me. Rank wasn't as important as power. I had the authority to cut my own orders to travel any place within the United States on my own authority. And I could park my car anywhere on any street in New York City for as long as was necessary. And I had to determine that. And my car could not be touched. I could park it in the middle of Times
That's
Square.
Convenient.
They couldn't touch it. And then I had memberships in the officers' club at Governor's Island, which is right off the tip of Manhattan. It's no longer a military base, but it was. And Fort Jay in Brooklyn, which was just across the
is
bridge.
Is that still there or not anymore? Is Fort Jay still there?
Oh, yeah. Oh. It's Fort Jay is right along, you know, where the Verrazano Bridge comes across on the Brooklyn side. There's a fort to guard the Narrows there.
Oh.
And that's Fort Jay. And that's where I was discharged from the military. And I had access to highly classified military officers' clubs, like the Atomic Submariners Club in New London, because of my clearance. Surprisingly, the negotiating team treated me as an equal. The prime contractor, Western Electric, was very attentive to me. They were located on Lower Broadway, and so we used to have lunch at the 21 Club or Keene's Chop House, or other elegant place with martinis. It wasn't unusual. And the Western Electric had overall responsibility for the success of the missile, of the product, under the basic agreement that our office negotiated with them. The legal team drafted the documents after the negotiation was completed. And we contracted for the Nike series, including the Ajax and the Hercules. And these were anti-missile missiles that were placed around the country, mostly around the big cities and military installations. So the question was, how do you counter incoming foreign missiles that split into multiple atomic warheads? The Russians had a missile that would come over and then open up, come in out of space, come down, and open up into 100 nuclear-tipped missiles come raining down on our cities. So how do you counteract that? Well, even though this may now have been declassified, it was wild, and so wild that still after 60 years, I don't think I should discuss it. How do you purchase unique items that had never been manufactured before? What would they cost? How long should it take? You're drawing a contract. What kind of a contract do you draw? Do you use a fixed price agreement like you're buying a car?
Mm-hmm.
Do you pay a flat sum for a total of 100 missiles? With a well, what we did was we did that. We negotiated a flat sum.
Hmm.
But we put in a clause that allowed the Army to compute the manufacturer's actual cost at the 70% of the production line and then adjust the contract price.
Okay.
So once we had produced 70 missiles, we had the right to go back and figure out how much per missile it cost the contract, and they could make a reasonable price, like a 5% or 10% profit on the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
and then we would pay the cost. But we didn't want them to have a benefit by having the costs increased.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the contractor gets a contract that has no control over the cost. So cost plus fixed fee. So they build the costs up. They put their son-in-law in the subcontractor or something.
Right.
And sometimes they want a percentage of the cost plus percentage of cost. That's outrageous because then you're paying them to cheat you.
Hmm.
So we had a fixed price. And then in addition, for a period of 3 years after the contract was complete, we had the right to go back and renegotiate.
Okay.
So it was pretty fair.
But at that point, you were buying an item that was very complex and never been built before. So
right.
how are you handling this?
You like that? Exciting?
Yeah.
You think about it, you're buying an item that's never been built before on a fixed price. So what we did is when we received the 70% production information, by that time that we got it and had to analyze it, the contract had already been 100% completed.
Oh.
Because it took us time to analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the contractor, they had obtained from IBM the first computers with the cards with the punch holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they knew the exact cost, what it cost them. They wouldn't share that information with us.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do. So I did a little digging and I found a statistical analysis course given by the military in Davenport, Iowa, at a ordnance installation there. And I flew out there and I studied how to predict what the cost would be and to do statistical analysis. And in those days, we used a slide rule. We didn't even have computers. All we had is adding and subtracting by
uh-huh.
computer. So I used a slide rule to better predict the final cost, and it came out pretty close.
Hmm.
How do you buy spare parts when you have no experience with what will need to be replaced?
Right. How did you figure that out?
You had to buy spare parts. Well, you have to guess. You don't know.
Right.
Spare parts are very, very expensive. It's like building the first car. You can't tell what's going to need replacement. You also have to remember that we were in the unique position of creating a defensive weapon that we were hoping would never have to be used. And thankfully, they never were. Almost all of those missile parts are probably still in storage, and very few people know whatever happened to the missiles.
Do you know?
I do.
Oh,
I'll tell you.
Okay.
To top it off, there were at least three levels in the Department of Defense, the Army, and the Ordnance Corps, each overlapping with its rules and regulations governing contract terms. So you had to draw a contract that fit into different levels of requirements and restrictions. It was not an easy contract to draw.
No, I can see.
And there had to be a prime contractor who was responsible in writing for the overall compliance and performance of the product. How do you get bids on top secret work?
Mm-hmm.
Has it occurred to you?
Yeah.
You have to have people
doing
it.
You can't talk about it. So.
Like you have to have radar that's built in and the shell casing and then the explosive devices and the guidance systems. All these bidders and every person involved in making the bid, not just the ones that get the job, but all the people that were bidding on this, they had to be cleared. They had to, including the administrative and the clerical people, the typists. They all were involved in high security risks.
Mm-hmm.
They would be getting all this information that was necessary to do a bid. So they had to be kept on a need-to-know basis. All we would tell them is what they actually needed to know,
mm-hmm.
and nothing more. And then we had to keep our eye on them to make sure that they didn't leak any information.
It was, how were you able to do that?
Well,
were there certain clauses within the contract?
We have counterintelligence corps in the military.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a little bit more about it because they followed me. They weren't worried so much about the contractors. They were worried about me because I knew the whole story.
Oh.
And they didn't want me talking to anybody. I was followed day and night,
huh.
7 days a week, 24 hours a day. My mail was opened. My phones were tapped.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that and expected that. It was very exciting. Then there was training and testing. How can you train people, operators, and how can you create charts and training aids and films and lectures when there's no history of experience with the weapon?
Right.
Nobody knows what it will do. I mean, we haven't even tested the thing. Mm-hmm. How do you test it? Well, if it's the type of thing we're talking about, you can't set it off. You cannot set off a test. There's no way to test it. So you use a dummy warhead or a less powerful one, and that's what we did.
And, I mean, I don't know if you're going to get into it, but where did these tests take place?
White Sands Proving Ground is where we tested it.
Oh, okay. Where is that located?
It's out in the Midwest, I think, in Utah or something. Oh. It was, I was invited to the test, but I didn't see any point in going. Because I got the results from the test, either it worked or it didn't work. And then we had to find out what didn't work and correct it.
You probably didn't want to be exposed to that anyway.
No, we weren't doing that.
Oh.
If you're talking about atomic explosions, we weren't.
Got it.
We were using dummy wires and things like that. You figured pretty good. You got a good mind. Anyhow, on the fourth floor at 180 Varick Street, we were on the fifth floor, there was the CID. Mm-hmm. The CID was military intelligence. That's between 12 and 25 plainclothes enlisted men. Their job was to conduct surveillance on the officers who had sensitive jobs.
Like you.
Like me. It was impossible to tell how many there were. You didn't know. Two of them alternated covering me around the clock. Mm-hmm. They tailed me. They tapped my phones. They intercepted my mail. But they were very careful not to disturb me. My fiance would always start her phone calls with, "Hello, everybody." Of course, you know her phones were being tapped, too.
Uh-huh.
One day, this quiet, refined, meticulously educated in the Chapin School in Wellesley. The Chapin School was such an exclusive school that nobody could get into it. He was in New York. I mean, it was very, very exclusive. And she was a New York society lady. That was my betrothed. She stood in front of my desk in the super secret office and greeted me. She came to see me at work. She said, "Hello." I said, "How the devil did you get in here?" She said, "I just walked in and waved to the guards and they waved back." I said, "You know, I got to get you out of here fast before we get into deep trouble. They should have never let you in." So much for super security clearance.
And did you ever have any run-ins with the security?
Oh, yeah. You never visited the fourth floor without being invited. So it happened to me. I had been living in a ground floor apartment in Greenwich Village with one of my dear friends, my oldest friend, Richard Fabricant, who was in the CID also. He was in the CIC, I think, Counterintelligence Corps, and he was stationed in New York. At any rate, we had this apartment in Greenwich Village, and we hosted a Saturday night party. And Charlie Snow, a vice president of Western Electric, honored me by coming to the party, along with most of the negotiating team. It was a pretty good party, and it spilled over. We had a backyard there. It spilled over into the backyard, and everybody was in a happy mood. Joe Larkin described how he was busy with 13 kids, but he always had time for a drink on the way home.
Oh, goodness.
He lived in Westchester. And on Monday morning, I was invited to come into the CID office down on the fourth floor. They took me into a windowless room, and the two of them sat down with me, and they said, "The Army regulations, they said, what was I doing with all these people entertaining in my apartment?" And I said, "The Army regulations said that if you were in a position where you had to accept some type of a benefit from a contractor, like lunches with martinis, and you couldn't get your own check or it would cause an embarrassment, then you should reciprocate in kind."
What does that mean?
You give back a party. You have to buy them drinks or something.
Uh-huh, right.
You can't just accept and not. And we were strict about that stuff. This wasn't like somebody living in the hotel when you live in the executive mansion and they're in your hotel next door to do business with you.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't own the hotel while you dealt with that. It was a conflict of interest.
I see.
Well, Colonel Cohn calls me in, the boss. He says, "Lewis, here's an invitation to my Christmas party." He said, "Because of you, I had to invite over a dozen extra people to my home, but I'm really delighted to do it." And anyway, I said, "Thank you, Captain Strauss," because Colonel Cohn knew who I was.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get treated like a second lieutenant. I got treated more like a lieutenant colonel. I was very, very treated very nicely. Our busiest time was in late May, and throughout June. It was the end of the fiscal year, and the word was out to commit every last cent before June 30th. We had to spend the money. Otherwise, how could we ask for more funding for next year? So things got so hectic that I asked my secretary to draft contracts to purchase training aids and charts to the extent of about $18,000. I read and signed them, but I didn't negotiate them. She did. My secretary was doing procurement. Congress learned slowly, but they learned. And a congressional investigating committee had scheduled to the office at 180 Barrack Street for testimony concerning our procurement practices and the amounts we were spending. Colonel Cohn thought that it was wise for me to be out of the country. He wanted me testifying because I was told spend the money fast or we can't get more for next year. So I was now a first lieutenant. So he says, Lieutenant, cut orders for yourself to be out of the country from July 15th for a month. You can use 2 weeks of leave and I'll take care of the rest. Go anywhere you wish. Maybe try Europe.
Nice. So, where'd you end up?
Well, they didn't want me around telling about spending money wildly in order to requisition more for the next year. So I cut orders to travel to about 14 countries, including Morocco, Egypt, Algeria, as well as all of Europe. I figured I'd put it all in.
Wow, that sounds like an amazing trip.
Yeah, and I told you my oldest friend, Richard Fabricant, had been drafted around the same time that I was called to active duty. Mm-hmm. He went to Columbia Law School. And coincidentally, he was also stationed in New York, in Lower Manhattan. And even more surprisingly, he was assigned to the supply section of a CIC unit located on West 13th Street. That's Counterintelligence Corps, only a few minutes walk from my office at 180 Varick Street. We even shared the basement apartment in Greenwich Village, as I told you about. And we took it for the summer when the rents were reasonable. Well, it's very possible that Richard's CIC unit was the same one that was conducting security for our ordnance office, and neither one of us was aware of it.
And what does the CIC do?
Well, the CIC is the Counterintelligence Corps. The mission of the Counterintelligence Corps is simply to stop secret information from getting into foreign agents. Mm. So stop spying.
Yeah.
Like the FBI. The CIC conducted surveillance on military personnel who had top secret clearance. They were followed and their conversations, their telephone conversations were monitored. And that's exactly what was happening to me. The CIC also looked at your lifestyle. They were particularly interested if a corporal started driving a Bentley. They want to know you were living beyond your means.
Or because you were receiving bribes maybe because of information that you were giving out.
Right. If you're going out to nightclubs like the Stork Club or something in New York and buying bottles of champagne and you were a corporal or something, you were highly.
Something's going on.
That's right. Well, my friend Richard was able to coordinate leave time with me when I was told to get out of the country. So we decided to go to Europe by military air transport. I had specific orders to fly, but Richard would be on standby. But he got off earlier than I did. So we went to MATS, the Military Air Transportation Service. That's the military airline. And its home was in McGuire Air Force Base, right near Fort Dix, New Jersey. So we got down there, and they looked at my orders. And some heads were scratched because I drew the orders myself. And the next thing I know, I was on a plane. All seats faced backwards.
How come?
They thought it was safer in those days to fly backwards if there was a crash. I'm not kidding. So you faced the rear of the plane. And we flew to Frankfurt.
Sorry.
Yeah, no one knows those things.
That's crazy.
We flew to Frankfurt, Germany. My friend Richard had gotten to Frankfurt 2 days ahead of me, and he became worried, but we finally found one another. We changed into civilian clothes, and we took a commercial flight to Stockholm. That's when we decided to hitchhike. So here we are, a couple of Americans in Scandinavia hitchhiking through Sweden. And we went all the way. The Scandinavians stopped for us. They were nice. And they all spoke English, and they were extremely friendly. We wound up in a very remote village, way up in the northern end of Sweden, right at the Norwegian border. And there was a loudspeaker playing the American song, telling the story of Davy Crockett in this wilderness. So it tells you about American culture being all over the world. We worked our way down to Oslo, and Richard left for home. He returned home. His leave was over. And I flew to London, and I stayed at a fine hotel set aside for American officers.
Sounds great.
I don't think they charged me maybe a dollar a day or something.
Very nice.
It was elegant. From there, the military flew me to Paris, and I was stuck. Each day I asked the Air Force about rides, flights to the U.S., no luck. Finally, after about 4 days, I was given a tip and I approached an Air Force captain. Otherwise, I'd have to come back by commercial airline, which is very expensive. Mm. So, and he was flying this huge cargo plane back to Long Island through the Azores. And he said I could camp out in the cargo area. It was a C-130. And the C-130 could accommodate two Greyhound buses back to back, you know, front to nose to rear. And what happened to me is worth a drink.
And what happened?
Well, I'm going to tell you in the next session, the next story.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you what happened. And it's called It's Good for a Drink, and it is worth a drink. In any event, we landed in a small military field on Long Island, and I called in, and I was back in the office the next day. So I was away 30 days. I was charged 12 days leave, and congressional investigators were all gone, and we never even talked about them, and they were never heard from again.
So what happened to your military career?
The colonel calls me and he says, Rest, stay in the service, and I can promise you a regular Army commission. That means a guaranteed 30-year career. Mm-hmm. And you'll start at a captain immediately. And I promise you that you'll get at least one star. You'll make general. Mm-hmm. And I thanked him very much. I said, thank you, Colonel Cohn, and thank you, Harry Strauss. But no thank you. I became a civilian.
And what was the driving sort of force behind your decision?
Actually, I liked the military very much, but I wanted to have freedom. And also, I knew that if you got into a situation where your boss didn't like you, your career was over. Hmm. And it was a very tenuous thing, tap dancing all the time, worrying. I wasn't a West Pointer. Hmm. You weren't on the inside. So I think the military is for people who go to West Point, really. The Army is, and the Navy is directed towards Annapolis, and the Air Force to the Air Force Academy. And you should, if you're going to make a career, that's the best way to start it and to follow it. Hmm. And I think I was out of place there, really. I would no longer be an attorney. I would be in the field with the Ordnance Corps doing other kinds of work.
Right. And you studied to become
like
a lawyer. So.
Like me, taking out the fuses from bombs that didn't explode.
It would have been a whole different life for you.
Well, your life expectancy is about 15 minutes in combat.
Yeah, quite shorter.
So, at any rate, I thank you, Colonel Cohn. Thank you, Strauss. But I became a civilian. Although there was no obligation on my part, I volunteered for the reserves without pay, and I was jumped up to a captain. Then when Vietnam came along, I was in line for another promotion. But it was time to retire my commission. I had a wife and a son, and I wasn't thrilled about the war.
Yeah.
I didn't like that war. So coming back through the looking glass, it occurs to me that there's a message. Serving one's country for a few years is a mutually beneficial and significant experience. It supersedes money. When you are ready to commit your life for your country, you better appreciate what you have. Hmm. And by the way, I think that applies to all countries. Mm-hmm. I think if you give a couple of years to society, your community, it's a wonderful thing, and you appreciate what you have, and you have pride in your background and in your nationality, and you're more considerate of your fellow man. Hmm. I urge it, and I think everybody should give 2 years to their country. Men, women, when they graduate from high school, probably is a good time before they go to college, and serve in some form, either if you don't serve in the Peace Corps, even if you don't want to go in the military. Hmm. But you should give a couple of years. So that's my story, and I have a rambling whole thing.
You brought up quite a bit, everything from sexual harassment to criminal justice and military pollution and the importance of government service. So definitely want to hear a little bit more about your take on some of these things.
Well, start about behavior and sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. I kept telling you that one of the reasons I didn't want to stay in the military is that you can get a commander who says, charge that pillbox. You're out in the combat, mm-hmm. and you know you're going to die if you charge the pillbox. And he doesn't care whether you die or not. He wants the pillbox captured. Well, you want to stay alive.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of problems with, you can't question in the military some decision that's made, you get in trouble. And you can't question the authority of a senior officer. And then there's a lot of hazing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of sexual discrimination. Sexual discrimination, not just against women, but sexual LGBTQ, whatever. Mm-hmm. Originally, in 1949, there were no gays or lesbians in the armed forces. And if you were found to be a gay or a lesbian, you got a blue discharge. You were thrown out.
Wow.
They didn't allow it. Then I think in 1951, the Uniform Code of Military Justice provided that if you were involved in a relationship with another person of your same sex, you were given an undesirable discharge, not a dishonorable. So they changed it from blue and dishonorable to undesirable. Then they had Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You remember that?
Yeah.
That was 1993. Mm-hmm. I think it was Bill Clinton did that. Mm-hmm. To 2011. And it stopped the persecutions of the gays, but that was repealed on September 20th, 2011. And now there's no discrimination between behavior between consenting adults. Mm-hmm. But there's still issues as to transvestites and queers and gays, whatever you want to call the different sections of the sexual behavior. Mm-hmm. Well, the hazing resulted in a lot of women in the military got raped, and a woman, a lady who's a private, goes out with a guy who's a sergeant or an officer, mm-hmm. and there was no fraternization between enlisted personnel and officers. No fraternization. So that if your boss was a captain and you were a corporal in the WACS or something, you couldn't go out with them. Mm. It's very interesting. A lot of it was workplace related, where you were in the same office with someone of the other sex in the military. So you have the same thing as you have from in civilian life. Well, they think they have 20,000 attacks. In the military in the last year, sexual attacks. 35% were penetrative. The Air Force, the Coast Guard are the best. The Marines and the Navy are tough. 26% of the women had some sexual assault or discrimination experience. That's one, and one in maybe 13 men had a bad experience. In 2014, there were 19,000 instances of unwanted sexual contact in the military. So they made it, Article 120, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, made it a crime to affect a sexual assault. But they have hazing. So hazing winds up with rape and lashings too, mm-hmm. and sodomy. Male hazing, drinking, intimidation, owning another person, where they say, I own you.
Yeah.
That's very common. Bullying, that's very common in the military. And they have, like college fraternities, and athletic teams, the military has elite groups, and they do a lot of that. The Rangers, the Airborne, the SEALs, the Navy flyers, the aircraft carrier pilots, you know, they're called the Tail Hook Club, which is, you know, you drop a hook to hook in when you land on a car. And the submarines and the Marines, submariners and Marines, they all are elite groups, and then you just can't come in and join them and expect to be accepted. It's not how it works. They haze you.
And have any of these cases been brought forth and have been prosecuted, the people who have done these things?
Or? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of them. And there's there's something called CATCH now, which is a service member is allowed to make a report of sexual assault and the victim remains confidential. Okay. It's made to the Department of Defense. And they see if there's other complaints.
Okay.
And if there's a match, then they start to investigate.
How is the confidentiality secured? Because you're dealing with people who are pretty much higher ranking. They have certain power and certain prestige. So they could technically try to get at that information. So how do they guarantee that?
That's a very good question.
Confidentiality.
It's a very good question. All complaints. And so you have victims' rights. And it's first coming into acceptance, the anonymity right of a victim, particularly women in rape mm-hmm. or sexual assault. But it's on all men too, men being sodomized. It's happened a lot. a lot of there was a case of some privates that were sodomized by a corporal and a sergeant that did it regularly.
Wow.
When you say, welcome to our unit, we own you. You'll do as we tell you, and there's nothing you can do. So there's a big problem with confidentiality, as there is in it mirrors civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same problem, and the answer is it's tough. It's a problem, and if it gets out, it gets out. It's generally protected. You see most women today who make a complaint about rape, who don't want to be disclosed, are able to preserve their, they have to decide themselves to release the confidentiality. They make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of books and stuff written recently about women deciding to go public, to get it out, to have it out that they were raped.
Do you feel like the military has improved its policies? It's a lot better now?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Much
and,
better.
And
much better.
Like, what are some areas that you identify could be a little better that you feel still has room to grow?
Well, I think what we're talking about is programs that you were saying the president was opposed to. Sensitivity training is very big.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've got to start in the military. Every person that goes on active duty in the military should take a course, at least 3 hours or so minimum, in sensitivity training, how people react and sexually as well as racially and religiously, all the sensitivities.
Mm-hmm.
And when a woman says no, it means no. And you don't pursue a woman if she says no. The military, they had, I think, the victims, the biggest victims, by the way, of this type of sexual abuse were inmates in prisons.
Hmm.
80,600 complaints in 2016. Children, 60,000 in 2016. And the military was 18,900 complaints in 2016 of being victims of sexual abuse.
Hmm.
Every one in six women is there's an attempted rape or rape. 15% are completed and the rest are attempted. Usually, in civilian life, the rapes occur near the victim's home most of the time, and only 12% at the workplace. And much of it comes from an intimate partner. The husband or the boyfriend rapes them.
Wow.
That's almost 25% of the time. And she says no, and he says yes. He says, I'm your husband, you'll do what I tell you. No, I won't. 88% of the women in completing a four-year college course experienced at least one incident of physical or sexually victimization.
Mm.
It's very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in the military, it's in civilian life. I really didn't get into a lot of the other stuff. I'm jumping. Suicide rates, by the way, in the military are pretty high. They got about 25 per 100,000. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
I think civilian life is about half that. What else can I tell you? I started
Definitely
to tell you about the black boxes, which
yes,
they denied.
Yes.
You know, I can tell you about toxic chemicals.
But tell me. I definitely want to know a little bit, at least. Throw in some
okay,
information.
Okay. You want me to tell you about the warheads?
Yes.
And the missiles that
you
knew about? Well, these were atomic warheads. And we had, as I recall, at one time, the United States had a huge number of warheads. I'm trying to think of how many. I think Russia had about 45,000 warheads, atomic warheads.
Wow.
And we had, I think, about 35,000, 37,000 warheads. In 1967. The United States had 37,000 atomic warheads.
Wow.
And so this is what accounts for the Cold War tensions,
mm-hmm.
because we had so many warheads. I mean, it was an overkill by far. Well, we entered into a thing with Gorbachev to drop down to 1,500 atomic warheads per country.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't reached that level yet. The last I could find, people don't want to talk about it. Was that we had 6,185 warheads still.
Well, it's gone down significantly.
Oh, yeah.
So
and of those, 3,800 were part of a stockpile, which we were only allowed 1,500, and 2,385 were in the process of being retired.
Hmm.
The Russians have less than we do right now. They have less. But They have, do you know anything about raw uranium? Stuff like that?
It's definitely not good to have around, laying around. Or...
Yeah, well, you can steal it. Mm-hmm. It's fungible. You know what fungible is? You can't tell who's what, who owns what, because you can't put a number on it. It's like sand or water. Mm-hmm. You can mix it up. You can't tell who's what. Mm-hmm. As I recall, we had something like 37 tons of uranium still undisposed in viable form. Mm-hmm. And the Russians had even more. Between the Russians and us, we have a total of 68 metric tons. And that's all plutonium and stuff, you know, and uranium. And the United States had more of it. I think we had 37 metric tons and they had the rest. So it's about, we had more than half. Now, that creates a problem because you have 37 tons of excess plutonium. That's bigger than the entire Manhattan Project, you know, it's the atomic war. Uh-huh. That was more than it took to produce the atomic bombs for Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. And that's sitting around. That's enough for 8,000 nuclear warheads. That's sitting there. And it can be stolen.
Yeah.
Where
is this kept?
Well,
obviously, we probably don't know.
It's kept at, no, I have an idea. It's kept in different places.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Not smart to keep it all in place.
No. And it's a lot of it is kept underground. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is being disposed of. So they, you know, MOXes, MOX, that's it's a plant or a system that disposes of nuclear fuel. Mm. So it's called mixed oxide fuel. Mm. And mixed oxide fuel is, they use a conversion plant for it. They're supposed to convert it into fuel rods for civilian nuclear plants. And one of the big conversion plants is in South Carolina because of Lindsey Graham. Mm. And it employs like 4,000 people or something, 2,000 people. And Lindsey Graham doesn't want that plant taken away. Mm-hmm. But the fuel rods, they find out, can't be used. They don't work. They're not compatible with the nuclear plants. So now they're sitting with all these fuel rods that they've made. Of course, the better, I think, the better method is to dilute it as much as you can and mm-hmm. dispose of it 2 miles down in the earth, 2 miles down.
Okay.
Now, they've done it
that's
in the water.
Enough?
They do stuff in the water. They put a lot of chemicals in the water. And they sank a ship right
that's
off Florida, the East Coast.
It's going to come back right.
Yeah, I think
right
they sank
us.
It off Florida because I read in the newspaper just the other day and it had nerve gas in it.
Oh, well, whose idea is that? That's just
12,540 rockets of sarin nerve gas. And it went down, and even they had VX nerve gas. It was sunk 283 miles due east of Cape Canaveral.
And is there no,
that's just
no
recently.
Smarter way to dispose of this?
Well, that was 50 years ago they sank this freighter. And so now it's a lethal cargo. It was, I think the boat was called the LeBaron Russell Briggs. And it was major chemicals from the Korean War. And the thing slams into the sea floor at 25 miles an hour. But it's down there. And so they're worried about whether or not it will start to leak because seawater erodes the metal.
Yeah.
And so now you're going to have all this chemicals, toxic chemicals leaking out. Well, that's...
Oh, Lewis.
It's more... it gets worse. It
that's
gets
terrible.
Worse, not better. We don't know how to dispose of it safely. You know what the half-life time means? Half-life means... The level of radiation falls to half at a certain point in time. Mm-hmm. And then you go another half and then another half until it goes down. It's a graph. It goes down this way. Mm-hmm. So the first half-life takes a long time. For example, uranium. Well, it depends on the mixture. Uranium, plutonium, it depends on whether it's 238 or 235. One of them takes 24,000 years
go
to a half-life, and the other takes 4.5 billion years to go to a half-life, and another one takes 5 hours.
Oh.
So it depends on the mix.
Uh-huh.
So what do you do with stuff like that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens if the terrorists get it?
Yeah.
What happens if it's stolen? Well, 11 pounds, and we're talking about now 67 tons. 11 pounds is enough for a bomb.
Yeah, so have I
given you enough? Do you want more?
I mean, if we're not disposing of it properly and we're not handling it properly with the information we have, imagine if it were to get into the wrong hands.
Well,
what could happen?
I haven't even talked to you about napalm, Asian orange, sarin and tabin gases, mustard gas, phosgene, chlorophen, lewisite, hydrogen cyanide. It goes on and on. Chlorine, bromide. It's all stuff illegal in warfare, and we got it. And it's all coming from two places. One, Aberdeen, and two, there's a chemical warfare place right outside Washington, D.C. There's a chemical corps. Then I haven't even talked to you. And, you know, I can tell you, we have like over 7,000 airplanes spewing out fumes.
Mm-hmm.
We have 6,333 combat tanks, just the tanks. Russia has more tanks than we do. We have a million soldiers in the army, over a million. I don't know how many trucks and vehicles we have, probably 250,000, something like that,
mm-hmm.
225,000 vehicles. We use up 270,000 barrels of oil in a day in the military.
Wow.
And none of it, you know, you never hear of a Humvee or a tank being fitted out with an anti-pollution device.
No.
You know, carbon emissions like California and after the filter. They don't have it. You know, these things get a Humvee. You know how many miles per gallon it gets? 10 miles a gallon in a Humvee. That's a Humvee. That's efficient. You try a tank. And we're running around, I'm telling you, we're running around with 225,000 vehicles just in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army has 6,333 tanks. And they're burning diesel. And we're running up 270,000 barrels a day. Well, I haven't got into half of what I wanted to tell you. It's crazy. It's crazy. We put out 60 million metric tons of CO2 in the military. You know, and we haven't even put in the military industrial complex. That, I think, is 153 million tons a year of carbon. They haven't talked to you about bombing ranges and explosive detonations. How do you get rid of the stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And vehicles and tanks and oil and pollution and trees and ruts in the ground and ammunition, the shelf life of ammunition and garbage and tires, burning tires in open air pits, burning plastics, sanitation, hospitals, chemicals, grease, oil, poison gases, greenhouse gases, phosgene, atrophine. All this stuff has to be disposed of. Groundwater contamination is enormous on military bases.
Mm.
Aberdeen's a cesspool, and nobody's doing anything. The Navy used to dump garbage at sea. Who's going to stop the Navy from dumping garbage at sea?
Yeah.
No one can stop them. Who has jurisdiction over them?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the only person that has jurisdiction over them is the President of the United States.
Well, good luck with that.
That's it. He's not going to do anything. There were toxic fluorinated chemicals at 678 military installations.
Nice.
They're all polluted. Nuclear fuel. What happens with the nuclear fuel in the Navy when they dispose of it? What do they do with
it? Where does it go?
That's right. Okay, I've given you a good idea. There's another plant, by the way, Pantex plant in Amarillo, that's holding over 20,000 platinum cores. That's also enough to cause thousands of megatons of nuclear explosions.
Oh, my gosh.
So I will tell you just a little more, and then I'm going to cool it because we're going to come close to an hour, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk to you about biologic warfare because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that I would give you an insight as to what else the military is doing to make you sleep at night. Okay, not sleep at night. First of all, biologic warfare is the use of a disease as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So you think that this virus is not possibly coming from some military lab, maybe in China? I'm not saying it is. I'm saying it's a high possibility. No one talks about it. I'm talking about it because I know a little bit about it. I'm not like Dr. Fauci. I don't make a career of it, but I do some thinking and I do some digging. And we have a long history in the world of biologic warfare. So you're talking about toxins, bacteria, viruses, insects, fungi. Give me some examples. Well, Botox, you know, that's a botulism, that's a toxin, that's a killer.
Yeah, people are injecting it on their faces.
Right. What about stuff like aflatox?
What's that?
Aflatoxin, that's a fungus that goes into damaging crops. So you can attack not just the people, but the crops. And botulism, the Botox, that's slow and painful paralysis, and it winds up in death 100% of the time. Then you have the Bunya virus, ticks, rats, bites, mosquitoes, severe viral hemorrhaging, fever. It's transmitted person to person through food. There's a 50% mortality. That's a lot better than what we've got. It's worse, you know. Then you have anthrax, rinderpest, that attacks cattle. You have the bubonic plague. You have pneumonia and the pneumonic plague. Mm-hmm. You have bacterial spread by fleas from rodents. You get pustules. You have 90% death from the pneumonic lungs plague once you get it in the lungs. And that comes from cough droplets in the air, the same that we have now. And it's treated with antibiotics. And there's a 10% death rate, which is similar to what we have. Then you have Ebola. Ebola has a 90% mortality rate. Ebola. No one talks about it, but it's still going on. There's
still
no cure.
Yeah.
And it's hemorrhagic. There's no cure. And it goes from human to human in the fluids. Then you have the deer fly, which is tularemia. And that's a bacterial infection. Smallpox, 70% mortality rate. Anthrax, 90% mortality rate. These are some of the stuff that the military actually stores and creates as a possible weapon. But that's all stuff that we're playing with this biologic warfare.
And you're saying that...
how do you eliminate stockpiles?
You're saying that the issue really lies now in the fact that we're still keeping these things rather than eradicating them.
Oh, yeah.
We're storing them, we're keeping them.
Oh, yeah.
And for potential future use. If,
no,
if we enter
possibly.
Some kind of a...
There's the Geneva Convention. In 1969, we stopped most of this. But there's the issue as to how we eliminate stockpiles. That's an issue.
Yeah.
And we're facing that issue now.
Would like extreme temperatures, exposure to extreme temperatures of these samples maybe be a solution?
Well, most, you can try to burn them and stuff, bury them, burn them. There's all kinds of ways. Defuse them. The result is, though, that it's very hard to do. And you don't know what terrorists get a hold of them. Even though the stuff was made illegal for international warfare by the Geneva Convention, still people ignore it. They violate. Look what happened in Iran and Iraq. They had a war recently. Do you know about that?
Mm-hmm.
No. Iran and Iraq fought. I think Iraq invaded Iran. They were in trench warfare. And they used poison gas against one another. They said, well, we're not members of the Geneva Convention. And these countries that were killing one another are now pals. But it was a terrible, terrible experience. Okay, does that give you a little bit of an inside ramble?
I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight, Louis.
Well.
But do you think there's hope? Do you think?
Hope springs eternal, my dear. You just have to do your best and try to.
Hopefully we can come up with
be
some strong solutions. Yes.
Solutions. And that's why you have to have an international community like the UN that puts pressure on people. And there are certain things that all countries can agree on. And one of them is to do away with terrible weapons of warfare that can ruin, contaminate the world.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Louis. This was very informative, and I look forward to our next one.
Thank you.